I'm actually substituting for Dr. John Aguanabe. Dr. Aguanabe, at the time he was asked to speak at the session, was the Assistant Secretary for Health. But he recently accepted a position at, I don't think you'd guess where he accepted the position. He accepted a position at Walmart. That's right, Walmart. His duties include overseeing the company's growing numbers of in-store pharmacies, vision centers, healthcare clinics. The other reason he was hired was to address the issue of healthcare coverage for Walmart employees. And we know that healthcare coverage has been a big controversial issue. Anyway, he had been the advisor, the secretary and health officer for in Florida for Governor Jeb Bush. Then he came and became the Assistant Secretary of Health. About his new position at Walmart, Dr. Aguanabe said, "Walmart touches the lives of many in the community, and this position provides me with a new opportunity to reach people in places where they live, work, and shop. I'm very excited to join the Walmart team." And I just mentioned this because we can compare and contrast our recent appointees to some of our surgeon generals in the past. Dr. Aguanabe was asked to speak about surgeon generals, but I think it says a lot, and it's symbolic of the corporate influence that invades government in almost every aspect of private life. There have been some wonderful surgeon generals in our history. One of those is Julius Richmond, a pediatrician who integrated pediatrics and psychoanalysis. He was particularly interested in how poverty affects children's psychosocial development. So can you imagine, this was in the 50s, and he was studying the effect of poverty on children's psychosocial development. He and a colleague studied how poverty specifically affected children's development in their first year and later success in school. In the 60s, Richmond joined Sergeant Shriver at OEO, the Office of Economic Opportunity, and helped implement the Head Start program. He was also an early supporter of neighborhood health centers. In 1977, Richmond accepted the position of Assistant Secretary of Health and Surgeon General. His accomplishments are too numerous to list. He promoted many programs, and Dr. Mullen mentioned his role in Healthy People. A few anecdotes of those who knew Julie, as he is called. First, Jack Geiger. Jack said, do I have a slide on that? No, I'm sorry. That's the next one. Jack said, "I knew him best as a pioneer and director of Head Start when he was at OEO. When Sergeant Shriver kept waffling and waffling about approval of the first community health center in Mississippi and not meeting us about it, I took the dean of Tufts Medical School with me, and we did a sit-in in Shriver's office while he was away on the Hill." So Jack comments this was probably the only time in the 60s when the dean was sitting in and not the students. Shriver couldn't get into use his office until he delegated Julie to negotiate with us, says Jack, which he did, and we worked out an agreement. And later, Julie became a very strong advocate of community health centers. And from Professor Leon Eisenberg, he said that one story I have that illustrates Julie's many roles in defending civil rights is this. In about 1974, there was a gay activist meeting in California. Excuse me. A publicly committed activist tried to enter the United States wearing a t-shirt for gay rights. Thus, there was no difficulty for the INS identifying him as gay. They pulled him out of line and wanted to deport him on grounds that he had a mental illness, that is, homosexuality. INS authorities contacted the Surgeon General's office and asked for a ruling on this. The matter was brought to Julie's attention, and he at once advised his staff not to allow the deportation. The INS was furious and appealed to the White House, but Califano's office backed Julie. For once, the INS lost a man with courage, lost because a man with courage stood up. C. Everett Koop was Surgeon General from 1982 to 1989 and served in the Reagan administration. He was also known for his work as a pediatric surgeon before his confirmation. His anti-abortion stance was very controversial, but he did survive the nomination process and later became popular with many of his former opponents. Here are a few quotes from Dr. Koop taken from an interview with Dr. Mullen in 2004. "The older I get, the more I understand the relationship of poverty in a child and poor outcomes in everything else. I'm not beating a socialist drum here, but unless we take into account what severe role poverty plays in the lives of many children, we will never be able to achieve good health, good child health in the United States." On smoking, he said, "I was furious at the deception of an industry masquerading as a legitimate business while luring children to an addictive drug that ruined their lives and killed them early." Also about the tobacco industry, Koop said, "The tobacco industry has to replace those it kills with new recruits on a constant basis. They need to find new and outrageous sources of income. So now their strategy is to spread smoking around the world." On the medical profession, he said, "I think the major thing that's happening to medicine is the gradual evolution from a pure profession to a profession that relies on businessmen to make it work. Money is the bottom line." Dr. Koop also addressed the issue of AIDS, which Dr. Mullen mentioned. And around the issue of AIDS, one sort of interesting anecdote I found was that he had trouble talking to Reagan, getting through to Reagan, so he says. And so he found a way to slip messages to Reagan through a special courier. And the only thing I could think of when I read about this was something out of West Wing, the TV program, that he was slipping messages to the president through a special courier. When he was asked about the role he saw for the U.S. in global health, Koop said that he would like to see an international health service corps that would, and this is important, would emphasize training rather than hands-on care and transmitting know-how so that others can do the things on their own. "We shouldn't be exporting treatments," he said. "We should be exporting knowledge so that other countries can develop systems of their own." Antonia Novello was the first woman and the first Hispanic to hold the position of Surgeon General. She was appointed by President George Herbert Walker Bush in 1990. Novello once said, "The people expect the truth by the Surgeon General," and this is something I'm going to refer to later on. During her tenure, Novello focused on the health of women, children, and minorities, but her tenure was controversial because of her anti-abortion stance and her support of the Bush administration on the gag rule that kept doctors in federally funded clinics from offering abortion counseling. The gag rule had kept other top people from accepting the post of Surgeon General, but Novello accepted. Joycelyn Elders was the first African-American Surgeon General. She had served under then Governor Bill Clinton as the director of the Arkansas Department of Health. Most remember Dr. Elders as an outspoken advocate for sex education in the schools. It was because her statement that masturbation is a part of human sexuality and is a part of something that perhaps should be taught that Dr. Elders was asked to resign her position as Surgeon General by Bill Clinton. I'm too embarrassed to mention the irony of Bill Clinton asking Dr. Elders to resign over that particular issue, so I won't mention it. Dr. Elders also argued for universal health care and was also outspoken about the issue of poverty. David Satcher served as Surgeon General from 1998 to 2002. Dr. Mullen again interviewed him for health affairs, and while he was Surgeon General, he focused on health promotion and health disparities. He said something very also important, as many of these, "The circumstances of minority health are tied to two things that we as a nation have not been willing to change. One, of course, is poverty. Minorities are more likely to be poor. They're more likely to be environmental health challenges. and all the things that go with poverty. We haven't solved the problem, and I don't think we're necessarily committed to solving it. The second thing is the health system itself, a health system of the kind we have where health is a commodity traded in the marketplace, often to the highest bidder, and it's not good for the people on the bottom. Even though Satcher was warned not to touch the issue of sex, he felt compelled to do so by his third year as Surgeon General, and he issued a report on sexual health. I'm mentioning, as the last Surgeon General, I'm mentioning Richard Carmona because of the recent controversy following his tenure as Surgeon General. He was President George W. Bush's first Surgeon General. Not too long ago, he testified before a congressional committee that he was censored from providing accurate information to the public on issues such as stem cell research and teen pregnancy prevention. He said, "The reality is that the nation's doctor has been marginalized and relegated to a position with no independent budget and with supervisors who are political appointees with partisan agendas." He stated that reports on mental health, emergency preparedness, and global health were blocked. The administration, he said, did not want to hear the science, but wanted to preach abstinence, which I felt was scientifically incorrect, he said. David Satcher and C. Edward Koop also told the committee that they had faced political interference, particularly on morally charged issues such as sexuality or drug use. This example of stifled speech is reflective of a much more pervasive problem in our country. The interference with the work of the Surgeon General reminds me of suppression of scientific information in recent years, distortion of scientific information, denial of tenure for those who speak out on controversial issues, denying and delaying permits for public demonstrations, new crowd containment techniques at public demonstrations, and this list is accompanied by other threats to our Constitution: suspension of habeas corpus, domestic spying, illegal detention of prisoners, secret prisons, extraordinary rendition, and the list goes on and on. Most agree that the primary power or influence that Surgeon Generals have is that of the bully pulpit, being able to speak out on issues that will help promote the health of the public. But if we have former assistant secretaries working at Walmart and others being muzzled when attempting to ascend the bully pulpit, Surgeon Generals will simply become puppets. We must put an end to these trends. As the American Public Health Association, we need to advocate for Surgeon Generals who will, as many have, advocate an end to poverty, identify the corporate influences that destroy the public's health, advocate for freedom of speech, support movements for human rights, and finally, will uphold the Constitution of the United States.
Thank you for a rousing end to our panel. And I have one question from the audience, and it's for any of the presenters. Please offer your thoughts on what guiding principles ought public health practitioners hold dear as we shape the future of public health in America. Anyone want to address that? What guiding principles ought public health practitioners hold dear as we shape the future of public health in America?
That's a good and difficult question. I've thought about it from several perspectives, but the one that comes back frequently, I had the opportunity to serve as Secretary of Health and Environment in the state of New Mexico for a year or two. And I had a feeling that my portfolio was different than the other cabinet-level folks. And this is a reflection. It could be in the federal level or a state level or a city level. And I don't know if it's true, but I do believe, or I did have the sentiment then, and I'll share it with you, that if you look at the Secretary of Transportation or the Secretary of Commerce or whatever the similar person might be. You want competence out of them, and you also want, at the secretarial level, a political viability. They need to be able to work in the political environment. A secretary of health or a chief health officer, the public health leader, and by inference, people in that chain of command, indeed need to have professional confidence, competence, and they need to be, particularly at the higher levels, politically able to work in the environment with legislative bodies, with chief executives, with the public. That is a special requirement of leadership at that level. But their fiduciary, their responsibility, their constituency has to do with a very bedrock element of human life, and that is health. And that does bring you into conflict with chief executives and legislative bodies at times. And for the health officer, that's a special calling, and it's a specially difficult calling at times when, on principle, you think that a particular position of a of an executive, a governor, a mayor, a president, is wrong, and you need to speak out for that in as evidence-based a way as you can. I do think that's different than transportation or commerce or agriculture, et cetera. There is a binding responsibility to the human being and to human well-being, and I think that is different. And it's particularly difficult, and it is one that I think many who have served in these positions have encountered. I will finish my comment by saying, and I was fired from my job.
Thank you. Question number two. What are the implications for global health? Anyone on the panel want to take on that one? And it's just implications for global health. It doesn't have a context.
I'll give 2 seconds.
Okay, great.
I'm no expert on global health. Jerry Markowitz and I wrote a book which we struggled through on the implications of 9/11. But certainly, I think one of the implications for our understanding of our responsibilities in global health is that health obviously is an international issue, and that it always has been. It's an international class issue, and because it's such a highly politicized issue right now, we have to be aware of the enormous stakes that are involved in defining our response in the ways we want it defined. And I think that we have to just recall and remember that, increasingly, the same forces that are trying to shape our health in this country are increasingly trying to destroy our health throughout the world. Not only is SARS and infectious disease a problem, but we also have to remember that many of our problems are being exported to third world countries, and many of the environmental problems and many of the industries that create our problems here in this country are really international problems. Tobacco being but one, chemical industry, proliferation of polluting industries throughout the world another. We just have to think about the same problems we have here and realize that they're all rooted in the international community.
Thank you, Dr. Rossner. Next question. This is a long question. Starting in 1997 and accelerating after 9/11, bioterrorism was elevated to a major public health menace, even though it had no impact on morbidity and mortality. The Surgeon Generals and even APHA signed on, hoping that it would mean more funding for public health. But the administration manipulated this concern with a useless and dangerous smallpox vaccine campaign to help build support for the Iraq War. Now we are paying billions of dollars researching anthrax and smallpox, as well as hundreds of billions for the war, while real public health gets less. How do we stop this manipulation and misdirection before rather than after the fact? Does anyone want to speak to this question? I'm sorry that you have to come up here. The question answers itself. Okay. Dr. Mullen will make a comment.
I guess I'd say a word for preparedness, realizing that preparedness has been preempted or co-opted for other kinds of activities and supportive activities such as the war, which many of us do not support. But I do believe we're living in a world that is ever smaller. I mean, globalization is one manifestation of that. The simple, you know, the frontier is closed. We as a nation no longer have a frontier. In fact, we barely have borders, as is the case with other nations. And the opportunities for catastrophe, either man-made or natural, are very much with us, and they're enhanced by high population density and the increasing both mischief capability as well as the natural capability of, say, power plants melting down or what have you. So as part of the public health portfolio, if I went back and talked to Dr. Kenyon, who was dealing with plague in San Francisco in 1900, as part of his portfolio of concerns, the kinds of things we're talking about now, some of them would have been there and others would not have been imagined. So I do think we're living in a world in which this question, I mean, the omnibus and I think somewhat more neutral term of preparedness, how do we as a society maintain a reasonable level of vigilance for events that are going to happen, is an important issue. And I think making sure the public health mission doesn't get distorted or co-opted in unreasonable ways. But I don't think we should deny the importance of a higher level of preparedness thinking and work within what is the public health community.
I just want to say that I also agree that we need preparedness, but I also understand where the questioner is coming from. When I'm staying with Barbara in Washington, and as we were driving home, right on just a local street, there's this flashing sign saying "Report suspicious activity." You know, and this is like on the side of the road in just this regular little community. And the reason that I say that in response to the question is that this bioterrorism, to me, is also this part of this environment of fear that we have. And I was surprised in the subways, too, or the metro, rather, to see the military kinds of things. And I got to feeling a little nervous about it all. But I do think it goes along with what I was saying about the Constitution and freedom of speech, that this bioterrorism, whereas we want to be prepared, does it lend itself to promoting a climate of fear that can then lead to suspension of our civil rights?